As a follow-up to Dr. Zeitman's comments on the intergroup randomized phase 3 study of androgen deprivation therapy alone or with radiation therapy in locally advanced prostate cancer, the ASCO presentation demonstrated that the addition of radiation therapy decreased the risk of death with a hazard ratio of 0.77, which was statistically significant, and the authors concluded that combined modality therapy with androgen deprivation and radiation therapy should be the standard treatment approach for locally advanced prostate cancer. The final investigator interviewed for this program is Dr. David Crawford, who began our conversation by reviewing a new and maybe encouraging approach to the oldest form of systemic therapy for prostate cancer.
Let's back up to the early 1980s, and that's when Andrew Shally was working in his lab and working on fertility issues and other things, and noticed and synthesized this decapeptide and understood what LHRH did. And LHRH stands for luteinizing hormone releasing hormone. Basically, what that did is traverse to the pituitary, and it resulted in the pulsatile release of LH and testosterone, and then the feedback was to the hypothalamic pituitary axis. And so now Andrew Shally, and I actually talked to him not too long ago at the 25th anniversary of the LHRH compounds, he said, I try to develop an antagonist, because with an antagonist, you create a roadblock on the GnRH receptors, whereas he couldn't for two reasons. One was volume, and two was histamine release, basically. And playing around with a bunch of compounds, he came up with a number of them, but the decapeptide, by substituting a number 6 amino acid, whether you put leuprolide there, leuprolide is leucine, and other substitutions to come up with other molecules, you change that around and you have something that behaves, and they're called superagonist. And so you give them, and what happens is you create a traffic jam and the LH surges, but then these receptors are saturated and they're beaten down by the LHRH agonist, so that LH goes down and subsequently testosterone. But along the way, some things happen, like LH goes up, FSH goes up, and also testosterone before it goes down. And so Shally stated that he wanted to develop an antagonist, and people have tried over the years. There was one called Abarelix that was developed under the auspices of Mark Garnick and his group at Praesis, that was plagued with a couple of problems. One was the anaphylactoid-like reactions and then escapes. And then along came a couple of others, and we actually studied several of them over the years, Neil, actually, and even in BPH, and we can talk about that if we want. And then there was a drug, decapeptide, called Degarelix, that was put together by the Ferring group. And there's 5 substitutions on that decapeptide to make this work. And so they start studying it, and they found out that this is what Shally really wanted. This is what you want. The pure drug is a drug that shuts off the LHRH receptor in LH and produces immediate drop of testosterone, equivalent to orchiectomy, and without some of the side effects. And so they studied that, and the study they did was against leuprolide 1 month, and that resulted in approval a year and a half ago at Christmas time. And the drug is given as a loading dose and then a monthly injection. I don't think there's any question that the drug is very effective in lowering testosterone quickly and maintaining castrate levels of testosterone, defined by me and others as what you should see with orchiectomy, which is about 14 to 16 nanograms per deciliter. Now, along the way from that initial Shally work came leuprolide, the daily subcutaneous. And that study was published in New England Journal of Medicine back in 84, 85 by the leuprolide group, which was Mark Garnick and a number of other people, including Claudet from our institution. And it showed that leuprolide was equivalent and had less toxicity than 3 milligrams of DES. By the way, 3 milligrams of DES had not been studied in a large trial before. The FDA gave them an approval. It was about 202 patients. That would never happen again, when and without long-term survival. And then all the other ones have been approved basically on pharmacology, lowering testosterone less than 50, which the FDA says okay, because that's how low we could measure before, but now we can measure down to 1 if we want. So that resulted in, it was one study that was done by Peeling in the group in the UK with about less than 400 men comparing Zoladex 1 month to orchiectomy and showing pretty much equivalence. But that wouldn't get a drug approved today. So the rest of them have been basically on pharmacology, the 1, 3, 6 months, and even the 12 months. Hey, I can lower testosterone less than 50, and I don't have a lot of side effects, and you get an approval. And so that's been the basis, and I've been involved in a lot of those studies. I did the 6-month Eligard study. So now we have a situation where everybody has gravitated to a 3- and 4-month depo. And along comes a drug which is really what you want it to begin with, which was an antagonist, but it's 1 month. And that's a big drawback because I hear docs say, well, my patients won't tolerate it. I don't know if I buy that because patients don't even know there's a 3-month. They don't even know a 1 month. They don't even know what they're going to get. So I think that's a little bit of a cop-out. So the issue comes down to this. Is the flare, the testosterone levels that go up, with the injection of importance? And number two is, do the mini flares that occur when you give a repeat injection, does that mean anything? And three, does FSH levels elevated have anything to do with outcome? So very briefly, I would say this, is that flare or surge where testosterone goes up for a few days after an injection, if you have bone mets that are causing pain or urinary problems, sure, it's an issue. But what does it do to the average guy that has biochemical failure and his PSA is just going up? Does that change in that testosterone matter? Well, it's been shown that when that testosterone goes up, so does the PSA. So can that be good? I don't know. I don't think it is. And then the other thing is that it takes, depending on what your testosterone level is, and this was shown from that clinical trial that was done and reported by Lori Klotz from the Decarelix Luprolide, is that depending on what your testosterone level, it can take up to 80-some days to get a testosterone level down to castrate levels with the agonist. You can say that doesn't mean anything, but I think if our goal is to lower testosterone, then we ought to do it right. We ought to do it quickly. And so then we're left with another challenge, and that is when you give a repeated dose of an LHRH agonist, particularly the 3 months, in somewhat less than 20%, you get a mini flare, which means because some of those receptors are not saturated, they're coming back. When you give the agonist again, you again get a release of LH, and you again get a testosterone surge. And so you say, okay, wonderful. What does that mean? Well, I kind of been skeptical about that. And what's happened is that there are two papers out there that add some teeth to the fact that this cannot be good. And one is by Juan Marotti, and he looked at 73 men who were on a 3-month LHRH agonist, in this case, goserelin. And he looked at testosterone levels and where they got to. And he measured them at least 3 times in men. And what he showed was that there was a clear relationship to the time of castrate-resistant prostate cancer to what your testosterone escaped. So if you had an escape above 50, you had almost a 14-month difference in the time you became refractory than a guy that kept his testosterone less than 20. And so now there's something relates to that. And the other paper is by Pericino, which was metastatic patients, and it's over 100 patients. And what he showed was that the 6-month testosterone was actually very prognostic as to what happened to people. And if it's less than 20, 20 to 50 or 50 and above. And the difference in survival rate, Neil, was 4 to 6 months and even more. And if we had a drug, a new oncology drug, we'd be pretty excited about that.
That's for sure. You see all kinds of papers with less benefit than that. What's the bottom line in terms of your own practice? I know you're trying to get patients on studies as your first priority, but outside a protocol setting, how do you go about selecting? It's either, I guess, an LHRH agonist or what's the other one called? An LN?
It's called an LHRH antagonist, but more properly it's called a GnRH antagonist.
Right.
Because it's actually an antagonist for those specific receptors. So my practice, as you mentioned, I try to get patients on clinical trials. First of all, I think what we've got to do is recognize the old saying, the emperor has no clothes. that there are LHRH agonists that are very effective, and there were the ones that have let us down. And I think if you read the package insert, the PDR, it says measure testosterone levels. And I would encourage people to do that. And if they do that, they're going to find out right before they give the injections that there are people that you think are suppressed and have testosterones of 70 or 35. And I just don't believe that can be good. If our goal is to lower testosterone, we ought to be lowering testosterone. There are agonists out there that are effective and have very good data on keeping testosterones down at 14, 15, 8, whatever, and keeping them. That's certainly castrate. You can't get away from the flare phenomenon. You could block it with an anti-androgen. However, it's not a complete block. So I think that, you know, I talk to patients about it. I encourage them, and particularly ones that we want to lower testosterone quickly and effectively, and that's a lot of patients, and that's where I'm using an antagonist. So I'm using an antagonist, which is Decarelix or Firmagon over half of the time.
And I'm going to guess if we could do a national patterns of care study, we'd see a whole lot less in the community than that, and even maybe in academic settings. I don't know. What do you think's going on?
Well, I think that there's been a slow uptake, but when people listen to the story, and the story is that you want to lower testosterone and you want to do it quickly, and you ask them what would be best, they're going to say an antagonist. Quite honestly, the biggest drawback to the antagonist is that it's monthly, and some people will get a skin reaction with the first injection that's abated and further injection. So the uptake is there. We are looking at this big trial, and we see other things that are out there that are probably important. And one is that alkaline phosphatase normalization in patients with metastatic disease occurs more quickly and is more pronounced, and there's not escapes that was seen with the monthly leuprolide. That's got to mean something. The other thing is PSA responses. There have been less PSA failures. And the FSH story is interesting. We worked on this a long time ago, and so did Arthur Porter and Ben Joseph. And FSH is actually a stimulant, a mitogen for prostate growth. It's been shown in cell lines and in vivo. And so FSH levels are actually very high with orchiectomy, and they're high with certain agonists. And Mark Garnick showed this with Abarelix years ago. You can have patients that are castrate resistant, that we call them right now. And as a sidebar, Dan Petrolak and I had an article accepted in the Journal of Clinical Oncology begging people to get away from the word castrate resistant because patients don't like that and called endocrine resistant prostate cancer. And showing that patients who are on an agonist or even orchiectomy will have responses with an antagonist. And that's probably based on two things. One is the FSH. It's there, but it's not level one or level two evidence yet. The second thing is further lowering of testosterone. And as you well know, you've been in practice for a long time and have seen a lot of patients. And you know that when somebody is failing their therapy, they're usually an agonist, that sometimes second-line hormonal therapy works with an anti-androgen, with ketoconazole, with megase, and now the real hot one is abiraterone. And one wonders if some of those responses that were seen were in men that had insufficient testosterone suppression, because what we're seeing with the antagonists right now are that some men will have responses. I think it's an interesting arena. It adds one more. We haven't had a new drug approved in prostate for a long time, and so I think that this is an important step forward.
What about the issue of anti-androgen therapy and complete blockade? Are you utilizing it? Do you use it with this agent?
Well, I've got a long history in the area of combined androgen blockade.
Yep.
We did the study in 89, published in New England Journal of Medicine in the Southwest Oncology Group, that basically was the basis of the approval of Eulexin or flutamide. And the concept was that this was really brought forward by two people. One is Fernand Labrie from Canada, and earlier than that, in some of the research work of an endocrinologist in San Diego named Jack Giller, who basically showed in the face of castration that there were men that had low levels of testosterone around, and the thoughts was that these levels would further stimulate cancer. Fast forward to today, and the 17-20 lyase inhibitors and abiraterone, they were absolutely right, and maybe right for the wrong reason, but So that led to the concept, where do those androgen levels come from, the adrenal gland? And so we can't do adrenalectomies. I guess you can, but it's not a procedure that's widely used or accepted anymore. Well, maybe we can block those adrenal androgens by an anti-androgen. And so that led to the combined androgen blockade study. And our study that I already mentioned showed a 4-month improvement in survival rate over daily subcutaneous leuprolide. And that's a new standard, I think. And 4 months is significant in people with minimal disease. It was 6 months. So as an oncologist, you well know that that's a real step forward. But it wasn't totally embraced by the urological community and others. And there's all the arguments. And one of the arguments was that leuprolide is just daily subcutaneous leuprolide is just not a great drug, and flutamide just made it look better. And, you know, I didn't buy that. I really bought the adrenal androgen story, and I still do to some degree, and use combined androgen blockade mostly with Casodex right now. And it begs the question of maybe some of these people were right, that the LHRH, even 3 months, let us down, and that the anti-androgen is the crutch. And so the thought is, with an antagonist such as Decarelix or Firmagon, that in fact you don't need the help of an anti-androgen. And I think that may be true. It still doesn't get rid of the adrenal androgen level, but I can tell you when we measure testosterone levels on these guys, and even some of the precursors, they're low. So I don't know if we know the whole story. I don't think anti-androgens hurt. The only thing they hurt is the cost. And the other thing is, if you use them alone, there's some toxicity, gynecomastia. But in general, if you use it in combination with an agonist or an antagonist, if you believe that, that it helps there, the side effect profile is minimal.
So just for practical purposes, if you are going to use Decarelix, are you using an anti-androgen or using bicalutamide?
No, I'm not. But in the clinical trial that was done, about 11% of men did get a short-term anti-androgen in that clinical trial for presumed flare in both arms. So I don't do it anymore. I see patients that the biochemical failure patients, the radiation patients too, are actually, I would think, a very good area where you would think about using this. Because if you just ponder this fact, when you give an agonist, so someone's going to get radiation therapy and you want to shrink their prostate and you want to lower their testosterone for whatever reason, when you give an agonist, you've kind of wasted a month or even more than that.
Right.
Depending on, and so if you give an antagonist, you get a more rapid reduction in prostate size. That was shown by John Blasco years ago, where he downsized prostates and he gave an agonist or an agonist in Casodex, and the reduction was quicker with the combination. And the same thing happens with an antagonist. So the company is doing studies in Europe and probably in the United States on the volume reduction, which is certainly going to be quicker, and maintenance of low testosterone. And also in their clinical trial, in some clinical trials, when the agent was stopped, there was a nice rebound of testosterone. And that gets into the whole thing about intermittent therapy. And if you're going to treat somebody with intermittent therapy, does it really make sense that we really want to lower their testosterone low, low, low? And I would say yes, yes, yes.
So the rebound then is quicker, for example, than with an agonist?
In the studies, there was a rebound that occurred that was quicker compared to historic rebound that has been seen in the past. But you and I will know that there's a lot of problems when you start comparing things if you don't have a randomized trial.
Sure. You mentioned bicalutamide monotherapy, and I've always been fascinated by that, coming out of having done so much education in breast cancer with tamoxifen and other endocrine agents, that to me, in a way, there was a lot of similarity. Where are we right now with that? Anything new with the, I forget the name of the adjuvant trial or the early trial that was done with that? And to what extent, if any, are you utilizing it in your practice?
Well, I have often said that the perfect drug to treat prostate cancer with, if you're going to use hormone manipulation, is an anti-androgen. And an anti-androgen that works. It binds to that receptor and nothing gets to it. And the problem with the anti-androgens that are out there that we use, flutamide, you needed to use two of them 3 times a day to work. Nalidomide was a once a day. And then Casodex at 50 in the studies that were done initially alone versus castration, orchiectomy, or Zoladex, did not match up. It was close, but it didn't match up. So that led to studies of higher doses of Casodex, up to even 450, 500 milligrams years ago. But they settled on a dose of 150, AstraZeneca did, in a huge effort on an international trial to look at various stages of prostate cancer. And it was in patients who were watchful waiting. It was in patients as an adjuvant after surgery, and it was in locally advanced disease and so forth. And unfortunately, what happened was in the adjuvant prostate trial and then the low-grade cancer trial, what happened was there were more cardiovascular events. And that just killed the whole program. So at this point, I think it's a great option. And I have patients on 150 milligrams of Casodex, which is 50 milligram tablets, three of them once a day. You can't get 150 in the U.S. If the insurance companies pay for it, it's wonderful. I think that it does offer, particularly in men who want to maintain their potency and cognition and a lot of other things. Hormone therapy is not without side effects. And even Casodex 150 is not without side effects. Primarily, it's breast. If it's unopposed with an agonist, what you have is your testosterone level actually goes up. It's aromatized to estrogens. And then you have an effect on the sensitive breast receptors, and you get gynecomastia. Now, it can be blocked if you give radiation ahead of time. It's not perfect. You can also use a drug you're familiar with, tamoxifen, to block that.
Maybe we can kind of conclude our discussion here today if I can ask you for an update on a couple areas. And what about the issue of PSA-only disease? Anything that's come out in the last year or so that docs in practice should know about in terms of research findings?
So you're talking about biochemical failure,
yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Biochemical failure.
You, as always, cut to the chase and got to a very important point, and that is PSA failure, biochemical failure, rising PSA, whatever you want to call it. You know, we go back in history, years ago, before we had PSA, when we took care of men with local therapies, we wouldn't know they had the problem until they had back pain or they had metastatic disease in a bone scan. And I remember it wasn't that long ago that Paul Lang called me and said, hey, this PSA marker is very interesting. If you measure this on men who have had surgery, and we're getting some of these guys that have elevated levels, and it looks like that's an early indicator of failure. And that, I have to give Paul credit and others for that. We do have a marker that's been heralded as the most important marker in oncology, for better or worse, and that's PSA. And it gives it a good barometer on patients that if they had surgery, you should have an undetectable PSA. If you had radiation, you should probably have an undetectable PSA, or at least one that's low and one that doesn't rise. And various people have given definitions of what's a failure in radiation and rise, and it's three consecutive, or it's nadir plus two, whatever you want to do. But the nadir plus two is the one that seems to be catching on right now. So now we've got a way to assess our treatment. So we fast forward to now. What happens is we do a radical prostatectomy, we do radiation, we have this marker, and we've got a marker of failure in some men. And depending on your series, it can happen in 35 to 40% of men that undergo therapy. And then the question is, what does it mean and what do you do about it? And so that's not so long ago when somebody had their PSA go up. We made PSA addicts out of people, patient-stimulated anxiety, whatever you want to call it. They had their surgery. They got their PSA. It was their PSA is undetectable. Everything's fine, and then what happens is you keep measuring it, and then it starts to creep up, and they get very depressed, and you said, now I'm failing, doc, and I thought I was cured, and what do you do? And so at that time, years ago, everybody kind of jumped on hormonal therapy and utilized it for varying periods of time. And I always tell the story, I think it was patients invented intermittent therapy because they would have their surgery. A couple of years later, the PSA is going up. It's Christmas time. They're wondering if they're going to see next Christmas with their grandkids. They go on an LHRH compound. Their PSA goes down to undetectable, and they're happy as heck. And then about June, their hot flashes are bothering them. Things aren't so bad. The PSA is still undetectable, and they say, that's it. I can't tolerate this anymore. I'm going to stop. And then it goes on and cycles around. The PSA goes up again, and they say, oh, my gosh, and then they go on it again. And that really did lead, and I saw that in my practice. That did lead to a lot of intermittent therapy. It's unproven experimental, but going back to your question, what do you do for this? How common is it? It's 60,000 to 70,000 men a year will have biochemical failure. So 28,000 men die every year from prostate cancer. So obviously, a lot of these guys are dying with, not of, prostate cancer, and we've got to be smart enough to figure out who needs to be treated. And I think we can credit a number of people going back to Charlie Pound and Steve Friedland and others who have looked at this whole thing about PSA and PSA kinetics and outcome. The take-home message, Neil, is this. People that tend to get into trouble and are at risk of prostate cancer-specific death are people that have PSA failures that fail early, so within 3 years of their primary treatment, people that have higher Gleason scores, 8, 9s, and 10s, but more commonly the third factor is PSA doubling time. And some people say it's 3 months, some people say it's 14 months. I just like to remember a year. Doubling time of a year is a red flag. So the most common issue of concern is a doubling time of less than a year. So that's wonderful. And you go, okay, what are we going to do about it? And then people have used hormone therapy. They've used it intermittently. They've used a lot of creative drugs and new drugs coming down the pike. Many things have been tried, the immunotherapies and so forth. The unfortunate thing is there are no large randomized trials that give us an answer. We believe that treating biochemical failure with rapid doubling times, with hormones, chemo, whatever we use, will delay progression, but we can't say that improves survival rate. I believe it does. These trials are just almost impossible to do because you have to have a control group where you're just watching somebody, and when they see their PSA going up, they want to jump. They're not going to sit there and watch it. And so that creates a challenge. So we've got this whole biochemical thing. It's the most common presentation of advanced prostate cancer. It's a great arena to study things. We need to do it, but we haven't done a very good job of, you got to have a control group that is delayed treatment or no treatment, and they've tried it in Europe, we've tried it in the U.S., and it just hasn't worked. So what do we do? In general, what I do, the practical thing, is somebody has a rapid doubling time after surgery or radiation, if they still could be a candidate for a local therapy, so somebody had surgery, might be a candidate for radiation to the prostatic bed. Somebody that's had radiation who fails may be a candidate for salvage prostatectomy or cryotherapy. That, in my experience, is about 20% of patients might benefit. So the bulk of them are micrometastatic disease unrecognized, and then it gets into hormone therapy, and you do it, and then how long do you do it? Do you do it for 3 years, 1 year, intermittently, life? It's all basically unknown. We need some better studies. We need different drugs that we can look at. There's the immunotherapy drugs that are coming along. There are other agents that may play some role. So it's a great area to study right now.
Are there any situations in a patient where you might consider outside a protocol setting, early recurrence, initial high-grade disease, rapid doubling time, younger patient wants to be aggressive as possible? Any situations where outside a protocol setting you consider chemo hormones, and what about the issue of hormone refractory PSA-only disease, rapid doubling time, again, chemo or wait for metastasis?
Well, there have been some phase 2 trials that have looked at earlier chemotherapy, and I think that's something that we've really lacked in studying in prostate cancer, the integration of chemo hormonal therapy earlier in the disease. And so do I do it occasionally? Yes. Most of the patients I treat with biochemical failure are treated off protocol. Because right now, the only one we have open is a Degarelix intermittent therapy protocol. And I do. And the patients are rewarded by the fact that their PSA goes down and they're happy. And then it gets to the question that can hormone therapy or chemotherapy cure prostate cancer? And if you ask an audience that question, most people don't raise their hand. I would raise my hand and I would say, okay, here are the reasons why hormone therapy, in fact, may cure prostate cancer. We did a study with positive lymph nodes, ECOG, SWOG. Another New England Journal article paper a number of years ago showing that men that got hormones for life at 10, 14 years are not dying of prostate cancer, whereas in the control arm where the hormone therapy was delayed, it was 30%. So for that group of men, I call it a cure. If you look at multiple studies with radiation, the BOLUS study, the RTOG studies, there is a differential in survival rate when you use hormones properly with radiation versus radiation alone. And I call that a cure in that group of patients. There are men who years ago in the VH studies that were treated, and even currently, that are treated with hormones alone versus observation for localized disease where there's a benefit. So And a lot of cancers, as you well know, cancer is a collection of genetic changes, and the longer it's around, the more genetic heterogeneity exists and less responsive it is to therapy. So what we can say is that maybe early hormonal therapy and these biochemical failures and adjuvant studies and chemotherapy will make a difference and cure people, and I certainly believe it. 10% of people with metastatic disease live 10 to 14 years, and in some cancers we call that a cure, and we don't do that in prostate cancer for some reason. So I think there's a good rationale for it and a belief that, in my opinion, that based on the facts that I just told you, that we have a chance of curing people. Your other question deals with becoming refractory, and that has been called hormone refractory and androgen independent, and now the term is castrate resistant, and as I said, I don't like that term, and I hope it's replaced with something called endocrine resistant prostate cancer. And so let's take a typical guy, actually a case that we could discuss. It's a guy that had a radical prostatectomy 5 years ago, and PSA went up, and he got radiation, and he had Gleason 8 cancer, and his PSA doubling time was 4 months, and he went on a hormone regimen, and his PSA went from 10 to 0.2. And it stays there for 2 years, and all of a sudden it starts going up again. And then it's 1, and then it's 4, and it's 8, and it's 16 over a period of 18 months. You do a bone scan, it's negative. A CT scan, it's negative. Whatever you do, it's negative. And so this guy is what we wrote up a number of years ago, called them D2.5s, which are patients that have biochemical failure, non-metastatic disease. It's a great area to study, but you know what? There's nothing approved in that area. There have not been a lot of studies yet. What we tend to do is we tend to study men that are castrate-resistant or endocrine-resistant men who have metastatic disease. And then what happens is we get to the point where somebody does have metastatic disease. They may or may not have symptoms, and their PSA is going up, and their castrate, their testosterone. And then you say the argument that I get into with medical oncologists is, well, let's wait until the patient's symptomatic before we use a drug like Taxotere. Yet in the SWOG trial and the TAX-327 trial, there was a significant subset of men that had minimal to no symptoms, and the benefit seemed to be there. So people tend to withhold chemotherapy and other treatments until the patients are, for lack of a better term, years ago, circling the drain. But now they say, well, they got to have some symptoms. This actually is a point of some concern when urologists and medical oncologists were getting excited about the first time that a new drug, the Taxotere, resulted in an improvement in survival rate, and then the urologist sends the patient to the medical oncologist, and they send him back and say, well, bring him back when he is more resistant. And then you go, okay, what are we waiting for? I think that's okay, you need to study it. But in general, again, it gets back to what I already said about earlier may be better. You know, you can argue that all you want. And so now we're in a situation where are we going in prostate cancer and this whole resistant area, this endocrine-resistant area? The building block has been Taxotere, and that is based on the SWOG 9916 study and the TAX-327 study, and it showed a survival benefit. And that survival benefit was 2 months, but it was longer in different subgroups. And so now we have building blocks, and so we saw studies with immunotherapy with GVAX. Unfortunately, both of those trials turned out to not be positive and stopped the study. We had the atrasentan story, and then that kind of got waylaid until we got it in SWOG, and now we're just finished the accrual to that. And the other big study that was based on the excellent work by Joel Pikus in St. Louis a number of years ago, and ECOG was CIGB, was basically adding Avastin to the Taxotere regimen and reporting fairly marked improvement in a phase 2 trial of survival rates compared to what was seen with Taxotere alone. And that led to CLGB doing a landmark trial of Avastin and Taxotere versus Taxotere alone in endocrine refractory disease. I just heard recently, and it's unfortunate, that trial did not meet its endpoint. So where are we? There's not a lot of things here on the horizon other than, I would say, several big things. One is maybe the atrasentan SWOG study is going to be positive. I think we're going to hear about the drug, Dendreon's drug, Cipolucel, as a new agent that can be used in this setting. I think that we are very shortly going to have an approval of this drug, abiraterone, which is a non-chemotherapy drug which further lowers testosterone in the Jack Geller way that I mentioned earlier. And so a guy's refractory, and as testosterone is 20, the thought is that abiraterone will further block testosterone production, not only through the normal axis, but the cell itself producing testosterone. So that's pretty exciting to see that. And then there is a new super anti-androgen around that Medvation has that blocks the androgen receptor and looks very positive. We're excited about that drug as another alternative. I think that what we may be seeing arising is because a couple of the very exciting new drugs are non-chemotherapeutic, Neil, is that we're going to be looking at insertion of these drugs before Taxotere or cycle with Taxotere. You know, all these things need to be looked at. I think that the goal is, and we're starting to see that in the horizon, is that to turn this disease into a chronic disease that people die with rather than of. And I think that's possible.